The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Our introducer for Mr. Hosseini is Morris Williams, who is a longtime friend of the Free Library. Please welcome him.
Well, welcome to a very, very special evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Our guest this evening, Khaled Hosseini, was born in Kabul, Afghanistan in 1965. From 1976 to 1980, he and his family lived in Paris, where his father worked as a diplomat with the Afghan Foreign Ministry. In 1980, rather than return to Afghanistan, which had recently experienced a bloody communist coup and the invasion of the Soviet army, the Hosseini family sought and was granted political asylum in the United States, and they relocated to San Jose, California. 4 years later, our guest graduated from high school, enrolled in Santa Clara, California, where he received a bachelor's degree in biology and then went on to receive a medical degree in 1993. As you know, in 2001, he started writing a book that was published in 2003 called The Kite Runner, which became an international bestseller and was just a marvelous book that has sort of taken over his life. And as I mentioned to him, I think he's found a new career because A Thousand Splendid Sons is a wonderful second book that was just published on Tuesday, and I hope all of you have a chance to buy it and to enjoy it as much as I have. In 2006, Khaled Hosseini was named a United States envoy to the UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency. Established by the United Nations General Assembly in 1950, this agency has helped more than 50 million people restart their lives and has won two Nobel Peace Prizes. This year alone, the agency will care for more than 20 million people, of whom 80% are women and children in 116 different countries. UNHCR provides both protection and assistance to people who flee their homes to escape violence, persecution, and warfare. The Nobel Peace Prize Committee has called the UN Refugee Agency the bridge between war and peace. To learn more about this vital organization's efforts, and in particular, our guest's involvement in Aid Darfur, a campaign sponsored by the United States for UNHCR, please take one of these special bookmarks that have either been passed out or be available on the table in the lobby outside so that you will learn more about this important organization, which our guest has made a primary focus in terms of his ongoing efforts. So without further ado, let me step aside and welcome our guest speaker, Khaled Hosseini, and I hope you'll join me in giving him a wonderful Philadelphia welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Morris. I really appreciate that introduction. Thank you all for coming here tonight. This is my second visit to the Philadelphia area. I was here roughly a year ago, I think, at Villanova University. And I've never really gotten to spend much time. That was a kind of an overnight visit as well, as is this one. And I wish I had more time to spend in your beautiful city and visit it and just kind of take in the sights. But I'm thrilled to be here tonight. I thank all of you for being here. Those are not hollow words. I really appreciate all of you taking the time to be here tonight. I have been through many readings where I've heard nothing but crickets haven't been through that. Your presence here means the world to me. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart. What I have to say next is not very subtle or pretty, but I believe that is the truth. Afghan women have been beaten. They have been imprisoned. They've been humiliated. They've been sold. They've been raped. They've been forced into marriage. And they've had their fundamental human rights violated. The story of the struggle of Afghan women is a long and tortured one. One that predates by centuries the birth of the Taliban, who were merely, frankly, the latest, if the most notorious and loathsome offenders. The image of the burqa-clad Afghan woman has sadly become all too familiar around the world and has prompted many prominent people to take up the cause of the liberation of women in Afghanistan. I was in Kabul in March of 2003. And while I was in Kabul, I too saw many of those women walking around the streets in burqa. And I remember, as I saw each one of those faceless women walking by, I remember wondering to myself, you know, what is her life like? You know, who is that person? What are her dreams? What are her disappointments? What is the happiness in her life? What's the sorrow in this person's life? This novel, which has been in the making for me personally for going on almost 3 years, is my attempt to explore the inner lives of those ubiquitous burqa-clad figures walking along those dusty streets. It is my attempt to look for the humanity behind a veil. At the risk of sounding highfalutin, I like to think of this novel, which is very, very dear to me, as my tribute, for what it's worth, to Afghan women. I like to think of it as my tribute to their courage, to their resilience, and to their endurance. I am tremendously proud of this novel, of how it's turned out. I'm terribly, terribly fond of it. And I know that you'll ultimately be the judge, but I hope that this tale moves you, that it transports you, that it entertains you, and that hopefully leaves you, besides any kind of literary pleasure, with a genuine sense of empathy for the women of Afghanistan and what they have endured and what they continue to endure even as we speak here tonight on this fine evening. This novel is the story of two women who are born a generation apart. Maryam is the older woman, and she is a timid, uneducated woman who lives in a village in western Afghanistan near the city of Herat. She has very low hopes for her life. The other woman is named Layla. She's a younger woman, and she is born into a middle-class family in Kabul. She is an ambitious, strong-willed woman, young woman with hopes for both personal and professional fulfillment. Tragedy unexpectedly brings these two women together, and they form this very powerful and unusual friendship that sees them through at least a decade or more of war and anarchy and oppression and, most heinously, gender apartheid. This novel is kind of a hybrid. On the one hand, it's this very intimate human drama about the domestic life of these two very different women and their friendship. And on the other hand, it's this chronicling of the perpetual cycles of loss and brutality and war that have victimized millions of people in Afghanistan, most notably Afghan women. I'm going to read you the very first chapter of this novel. And this passage is about the older woman named Mariam, who is the one of the two central characters in this novel. Mariam is the illegitimate child of a lowly, embittered, and disgraced housemaid that Mariam refers to as Nana, and a wealthy businessman who owns a theater and several businesses in the city of Herat, which is about 400 miles from Kabul. She lives in a shack on the outskirts of the remote village outside the city of Herat, where her father lives in the city with his three wives and his 10 legitimate children. Despite this, despite that that they have been cast out of her father's house, Mariam adores her father, who is named Jalil. And her childhood life revolves around Thursdays, which is the day that her father, and the one day of the week that her father comes from Herat to visit with her at this little shack and brings her small presents. Naively, Mariam dreams of living with her father in the city as his acknowledged and legitimate and accepted daughter and part of his greater family. But when she pursues this dream of belonging and of making this connection, tragedy follows, and Mariam's life and changes forever. So I'm going to read the first chapter of this novel. And at this stage, Mariam is a child, and this is roughly the 1970s, mid-1970s or so in Kabul, in Herat, the city of Herat. Mariam was 5 years old the first time she heard the word harami. It happened on a Thursday. It must have, because Mariam remembered that she'd been restless and preoccupied that day, the way she was only on Thursdays, the day when her father, Jalil, visited her at the shack. To pass the time until the moment that she would see Jalil at last, crossing the knee-high grass in the clearing and waving, Mariam had climbed the chair and taken down her mother's Chinese tea set. The tea set was a sole relic that Mariam's mother, Nana, had of her own mother, who had died when Nana was two. Nana cherished each blue and white porcelain piece, the graceful curve of the pot's spout, the hand-painted finches and chrysanthemums, the dragon on the sugar bowl meant to ward off evil. It was this last piece that slipped from Mariam's fingers, that fell to the wooden floorboards of the shack and shattered. When Nana saw the bowl, her face flushed red, and her upper lip shivered, and her eyes, both the good and the lazy, settled on Mariam in a flat, unblinking way. Nana looked so mad that Mariam feared the jinn would enter her mother's body again. But the jinn didn't come, not that time. Instead, Nana grabbed Mariam by the wrists, pulled her close, and through gritted teeth said, "You're a clumsy little harami. This is my reward for everything I've endured, an heirloom-breaking, clumsy little harami." At the time, Mariam did not understand. She didn't know what this word harami, bastard, meant. Nor was she old enough to appreciate the injustice, to see that it is the creators of the harami who are culpable, not the harami, whose only sin is being born. Mariam did surmise, by the way Nana said the word, that it was an ugly, loathsome thing to be a harami, like an insect, like the scurrying cockroaches Nana was always cursing and sweeping out of the shack. Later, when she was older, Mariam did understand. It was the way Nana uttered the word, not so much saying it as spitting it at her, that made Mariam feel the full sting of it. She understood then what Nana meant. that a harami was an unwanted thing, that she, Maryam, was an illegitimate person who would never have legitimate claim to the things that other people had, things such as love, family, home, and acceptance. Jalil never called Maryam this name. Jalil said she was his little flower. He was fond of sitting her on his lap and telling her stories, like the time he told her that Herat, the city where Maryam was born in 1959, had once been the cradle of Persian culture, the home of writers, painters, and Sufis. "You couldn't stretch a leg here without poking a poet in the ass," he laughed. Jalil told her the story of Queen Gauhar Shad, who had raised the famous minarets as her loving ode to Herat back in the 15th century. He described to her the green wheat fields of Herat, the orchards, the vines pregnant with plump grapes, the city's crowded, vaulted bazaars. "There's a pistachio tree," Jalil said one day, "and beneath it, Maryam Jo, is buried none other than the great poet Jami." He leaned in and whispered, "Jami lived over 500 years ago. He did. I took you there once, to the tree. You were little. You wouldn't remember." It was true. Maryam didn't remember. And though Maryam would live the first 15 years of her life within walking distance of Herat, she would never see this storied tree. She would never see the famous minarets up close. And she would never pick fruit from Herat's orchards or stroll its wheat fields of wheat. But whenever Jalil talked like this, Maryam would listen with enchantment. She would admire Jalil for his vast and worldly knowledge. She would quiver with pride to have a father who knew such things. "What rich lies," Nana said after Jalil left. "Rich man telling rich lies. He never took you to any tree. And don't let him charm you. He betrayed us, your beloved father. He cast us out. He cast us out of his big fancy house like we were nothing to him, and he did it happily." Maryam would listen dutifully to this. She never dared say to Nana how much she disliked her talking this way about Jalil. The truth was that around Jalil, Maryam did not feel at all like a harami. For an hour or two every Thursday, when Jalil came to see her, all smiles and gifts and endearments, Maryam felt deserving of all the beauty and bounty that life had to give. And for this, Maryam loved Jalil, even if she had to share him. Jalil had 3 wives and 9 children, 9 legitimate children, all of whom were strangers to Maryam. He was one of Herat's wealthiest men. He owned a cinema, which Maryam had never seen. But at her insistence, Jalil had described it to her. And so she knew that the facade was made of blue and tan terracotta tiles, that it had private balcony seats and a trellised ceiling. Double swinging doors opened into a tile lobby where posters of Hindi films were encased in glass displays. On Tuesdays, Jalil said one day, kids got free ice cream at the concession stand. Nana smiled demurely when he said this. She waited until he had left the shack before snickering and saying, "The children of strangers get ice cream. What do you get, Maryam? Stories of ice cream." In addition to the cinema, Jalil owned land in Karoch, land in Farah, 3 carpet stores, a clothing shop, and a black 1956 Buick Roadmaster. He was one of Herat's best-connected men, friend of the mayor and the provincial governor. He had a cook, a driver, and 3 housekeepers. Nana had been one of the housekeepers until her belly began to swell. "When that happened," Nana said, "the collective gasp of Jalil's family sucked the air out of Herat. His in-laws swore blood would flow. The wives demanded that he throw her out. Nana's own father, who was a lowly stone carver in the nearby village of Guldaman, disowned her. Disgraced, he packed his things and boarded the bus to Iran, never to be seen or heard from again. Sometimes, Nana said early one morning as she was feeding the chickens outside the shack, sometimes I wish my father had had the stomach to sharpen one of his knives and do the honorable thing. It might have been better for me. She tossed another handful of seeds into the coop, paused, and looked at Maryam. Better for you too, maybe. It would have spared you the grief of knowing you are what you are. But he was a coward, my father. He didn't have the dil, the heart for it. Jalil didn't have the dil either, Nana said, to do the honorable thing, to stand up to his family, to his wives and in-laws, and accept responsibility for what he had done. Instead, behind closed doors, a face-saving deal had been quickly struck. And the next day, he had made her gather her few things from the servants' quarters where she'd been living and sent her off. You know what he told his wives by way of defense? That I forced myself on him. That it was my fault. Didi, you see? This is what it means to be a woman in this world. Nana put down the bowl of chicken feed. She lifted Maryam's chin with a finger. Look at me, Maryam. Reluctantly, Maryam did. Nana said, learn this now, and learn it well, my daughter. Like a compass needle that points north, a man's accusing finger always finds a woman. Always. You remember that, Maryam. You remember that. And that's the end of chapter 1. Thank you. My favorite part of these things is always talk to you guys and to take your questions and kind of get into a conversation with you guys instead of me standing up here and kind of blabbing away. So I'll open it up to you guys.
Folks, let me tell you the way this works, and I see a lot of new faces, so let me explain it briefly. Put your hand up. I will call on you. We'll try to get to all the questions. If you could keep them brief, there are a lot of people in here tonight. So, and please wait for the mic. We will get a microphone to you right here in the third row, Amanda. Could you keep your hand up so we can get the mic?
Is there a connection between the two stories?
I'm sorry?
Is there a connection between Kite Runner and the new story?
In terms of plot, there's no connection between the two, although those of you who have maybe a handful of you who maybe have read this book already, there is a tiny little bit of overlap somewhere near the end of the book. I like to think of this novel in some ways as a corollary, not a sequel in any way, but as a corollary to The Kite Runner, in that they're both love stories. They're both stories of love found in the most unlikely places. In The Kite Runner, it was these two boys who came from, you know, different ends of, polar ends of society, and yet they were like brothers. In this novel, it's a story of this unlikely love between these two very, very different women. One, Maryam, that you just heard from. The other, this ambitious and strong-willed and lively young woman who wants to go to university, who wants to become a professional, and who's raised in a family that encourages her to do those things. And yet somehow they find each other, and there's this very special bond between them. So I the connection between these two novels is these unlikely and improbable human connections that redeem these characters. But plot-wise, no, I steered clear of The Kite Runner.
Right here in the front row.
I love Kite Runner, and I'm sure I'm going to love this book. In Afghanistan now, the plight of women, I've been reading that the Taliban is coming back into power. Has it gotten better? Is it? Where do you see it just as an observer?
Well, I don't know that the Taliban are coming back to power. They're certainly causing a lot of trouble. It's a difficult question to answer because when you say, how are women doing in Afghanistan, The answer is where in Afghanistan. There's always been a divide between Kabul, which has traditionally been liberal and kind of progressive and where all the reforms began, and the countryside, which has always been religious, ultra-religious, conservative, and tribal. In the urban areas like Kabul, you know, women are back in the workforce. They're not required by law to cover. They're working in the government. They teach at schools. They work in hospitals. Some sit in the parliament. You know, women sing on TV. They lift weights at Gold's Gym. That's a significant and measurable difference. And it's meaningful. In the countryside, those areas have never effectively been ruled by Kabul. And the reforms in Kabul have never successfully made it out there. There have been multiple attempts to liberate women in Afghanistan, to give them more autonomy. It happened in the 20s, it happened in the 50s, in the 70s, and in the 80s. But Kabul's attempts to give women in the countryside more autonomy has been met with mockery or contempt or disregard or in some cases rebellion. Afghanistan is a country where kings have lost their throne largely on the basis of women's issues. And so in the countryside today, women are there's still rampant illiteracy among women. They're still forced into marriage, often at a very young age. They still have to cover. They still can't work. What can you do? I think that is a incredibly nice, kind, and well-intentioned and meaningful thing to say. But if previous attempts at liberating women in Afghanistan have shown anything, and this is my personal opinion, is that change has to come from within. There have been attempts to bring about change several times, and it's failed. I think change has to come from within the Afghan society itself. And in my opinion, part of that has to do with trying to loosen the grip of this strict religious mentality that opposes Afghan women's autonomy in the countryside. But how do you do that? That's, I think, one of the central challenges of this regime. How do you bring women back into the fold? How do you give women a voice in regions where they've been voiceless and faceless for such a long time? And I want to stress, long before the Taliban. The Taliban became very notorious, but Taliban-style oppression of women goes back hundreds of years. It ain't nothing new. It became notorious because they befriended these folks who brought down the Twin Towers, and suddenly everybody was interested. But it's been going on for a long time.
Another question. Back here on my right. Would you keep your hand up, please? Thanks.
Hello.
Hi.
When you went back to Afghanistan in 2003, did the people there, did they consider you a traitor or just merely a dollar sign or both? Just because you left the country and came to America.
A traitor, what's the second part?
Or a dollar sign, just because you were from America.
A what?
Dollar sign.
A dollar sign?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Jeez. You know, when I went to Afghanistan, I felt like a dollar sign. I thought of myself as a bit of a traitor. You know, there's this thing called survivor's guilt. You know, I have been one of the most ridiculously fortunate Afghans on earth. And when I went to Afghanistan and I saw the magnitude of the suffering that people had gone through, you know, you can't help but wonder as a human being, what did I do to deserve being spared all of that? And have I made good use of the opportunity that I've been given? Am I fully deserving of this great fortune? And I don't know, I mean, the answer to that, I don't know. But The people there were, the people were there were gracious. They were incredibly kind. Nobody called me a dollar sign. Nobody called me a traitor. People welcomed me into their homes. Even the most impoverished of the individuals that I met invited me for tea and dinner, and they made me feel very much at home. And they never once made me feel bad. Any uncomfortable feeling that I had came from my own psychology and not at all from the people that I met.
Another question. Third row here in the red.
Hi. We're here with about 30 students from Lower Moreland High School who've read The Kite Runner in class. And first, I want to thank you for writing a book that has made ninth graders want to read when they go home.
Thanks very much.
Give it up. And secondly, I want to ask you, what would you like for young people to take away from the novels you write? What would you like them to remember from those novels, either character-wise or just kind of the big picture of the novel?
It's hard for me to say that there's a great overriding message that I want to get across. Ultimately, the point of fiction, that everybody has to take away their own message. But I want people to understand that in many ways, people in Afghanistan, and by extension, people in Iraq and these other countries that we always hear about in the news, are just like everybody else in this room. I don't think that this novel, The Kite Runner, has appealed to people because it happens to be set in a country where there are American GIs. I think the reason people respond to that novel is because it's about very human things. You know, that novel is about forgiveness and love and friendship and loss. And this novel is about love, and it's first and foremost a love story. And those are universally human experiences. And so I hope that people walk away with the sense that, yeah, it's a remote country, it's an impoverished country, they have a different culture, they have a different faith, but at the end of the day, people are people. They want the same things. They want the children to be safe. They want a roof over their head. They want to be able to feed their families. They want, when they're sick, they want to see a doctor, and they want education. And people are not very different from each other when it comes right down to it. So,
gentleman in the middle in the blue. Mike's coming to you.
If I may ask you something a little personal, I've been very curious about your motivation to write The Kite Runner, and here you are, as I understand it, a doctor who suddenly evidently veered off course or somehow somehow decided to sit down and write this absolutely magnificent novel of a first novel. What motivated you? Why did you choose to do that? What was your thinking at the time?
Well, thank you. It's very, very kind. I actually was writing long, long, long before the thought of going to medical school ever crossed my mind. I pretty much started writing when I could hold a pen. And I distinctly remember being a kid in Kabul and telling stories to I'm the oldest of five, but telling stories to my little brothers and my sister. And them actually paying attention. You know? I used to write little plays, and then I would coerce my cousins and my brothers into acting in them. And then we would practice, and then we would stage it for our families at like get-togethers. I've always had this impulse to create stories, and I've always been very, very happy when I'm indulging that impulse. I don't know why, but I think I was just in the famous words of Jessica Rabbit, I was drawn that way. So I kind of was in the writing long before I went to medical school, and I actually veered off course when I went to medical school. So I wrote this novel, The Kite Runner, back in beginning in 2001, and it was based on a short story which I had written a couple of years before when I had seen a report about the Taliban on television. And eventually that short story resurfaced in my house, and I expanded it into a novel beginning in March of 2001. But I've been writing most of my life, just never to be published.
How things change. We're here in the third row.
How well read is the kite runner in Afghanistan?
Well, there's no way of knowing, but I get periodic emails from Afghanistan, from Kabul, from Herat. And my sense is that people read it in English and that they've started to read it in Farsi as well, because there was a Farsi translation in Iran that's made its way into Afghanistan. And now I hear there's somebody in Germany who's translated into Dari, which is the Afghan, for better word, version of Farsi. Essentially the same language. You know, most of the reaction that I've gotten to this novel has been incredibly positive, incredibly supportive. People see their own tragedies on the pages of this book. They recognize something that happened to them or to their cousin or to their friend. And there's also, I get the feeling that there's a sense of kind of nationalistic pride, you know, that one of ours kind of published a novel that people are reading. So there's that as well. So by and large, very good. You know, that's not to say that everybody likes my novel. In fact, in my own community, it's fair to say that my novel has caused, you know, pretty good controversy. You know, it's a novel that deals with very uneasy subject matters, extremism, discrimination, contempt and rivalry between the ethnic groups. Those are, you know, very, very taboo and sensitive subjects in Afghanistan. It's not like you can walk into a party and start talking about these things openly. And people are very guarded about these things. And that novel talks about it very openly and in a very unveiled kind of way. And so for that reason, the criticism has never been, well, this never happened. This isn't true. Criticism is always like, why are you doing this? I mean, you must be out to make a buck to be rocking the boat like this. You know, dollar sign you. You know, why do you have to air out dirty laundry and embarrass us? But I never have understood that for two reasons. A, I never thought it was a job of the novelist to make everybody happy. You know, I thought people wrote about things that happened that were unpleasant and were uncomfortable, things that people didn't want to talk about openly. And secondly, I have, in 4 years since that novel has been published, I have received thousands, if not, frankly, tens of thousands of emails and letters. And there has not been one single response that I have received where a person has said, I can't believe you Afghan people. You know, you people are nuts. You know, are you racists? Are you this? 90% of what I receive from non-Afghans is that we, as a result of reading your story, I have more compassion for what's happened to you people in Afghanistan. How can I help? You know, I admire the pride of your nation, the resilience of your people. I'm sorry for what's happened to your country. It's incredibly positive. I've had people write to me and say they want to adopt Afghan children. I cannot tell you the number of times people write to me and say, how can I donate money to Afghanistan? Where do I send my money? How are those embarrassments? You know, if I sound a little defensive, I am, because I don't think there's any basis to those claims. So I think that the novel has had a lot of positive effects. So anyway.
Further back on the right, gal with her hand up. And keep your hand up, please.
Hi. Is there any personal connection between A Thousand Splendid Suns and your life?
That first, you know, the thing about first novels is that they tend to be more autobiographical than subsequent novels. And in a way, you know, when I wrote The Kite Runner and it was done and it was time to write another book, I kind of felt like I have exhausted myself. You know, I'm kind of like a hollow shell. Everything I ever knew, felt, thought I understood, I put into that novel. And there's nothing left. And then a funny thing happens, and as I sat down sometime in 2004, and I began writing this second novel, and I found out that I had a whole lot more to say. And I found myself so enchanted by these two women. And I felt so invested in their world. And they permeated my every thought for almost 3 years. And this particular novel, there's a lot less of me on the pages. In The Kite Runner, whenever I got stuck, I could kind of cheat, you know, and like pluck something out of my life and put it. I mean, I say that facetiously. But in the sense that this novel dealt with things that I did not directly experience, as it were. For that reason, this novel to me feels like a bigger accomplishment. And there's a part of me that's even more proud of having finished this book than that first one.
Another question. Second row right here.
Will The Kite Runner be made into a movie?
It's already been made into a movie. The shooting wrapped last Christmas, and the film is in that what they call post-production, meaning that they're adding music and special effects and fixing the dialogue and whatnot. So that film should be out, I was told, in November of this year. Likely premiere at some festivals before that, but in the U.S. it should be in limited release on, I think, November 2nd, and just kind of gradually expand the number of theaters where it's playing by Christmas time. Yeah.
About six
somebody words, said dollar sign. Yeah.
Gentleman in the green about six rows back here.
Hi, thank you. Pleasure to hear you speak.
Thank you.
This is sort of related to that gentleman's question before. How do you feel your background in medicine has helped or, for that matter, hindered you in your writing and then now your work with the UN?
My life of practicing medicine had its own rewards, and they were distinct from writing. They had to do with a whole different set of things. And my satisfaction from medicine. Medicine, especially primary care, is a people skill. You know, 90% of medicine, especially general medicine, is a people skill, is knowing how to speak to people. So the rewards of medicine come from just interaction with other people. But I don't think there's a whole lot of overlap between my medical life and, in fact, I compartmentalized my life specifically that way. I wrote from 5 in the morning until 8, and then at 8:30 I went to work, and I did my medicine job. And then the next day, you know, I kind of wanted a diversion from medicine. I kind of wanted to keep the two halves of my life separate. I haven't practiced in 2.5 years, so I'm on an open-ended sabbatical. As far as the UN, my work with the UN and how it, you know, it's too early for me to know. I don't know quite yet.
Let's keep going here. Let's move back. There's a gentleman in the red.
What is wrong with Afghan men in these societies? Is it they were been so isolated for so long that they don't see the truth of their... the societies that they participate in?
Well, I want to draw a distinction. Is when you say Afghan men, I think that's a generalization. If you read this novel, there are other men in this novel who are, I think, far more admirable. And I think that reflects the reality in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not a homogeneous country where every person thinks the same way. You know, there's a character, the father of the character of Layla, who's the young woman in Kabul. For all practical purposes, he's a feminist. I mean, he is a former teacher who wants his daughter to finish high school and wants her to go to university. He wants her to get a job, be a professional. He wants her to wait before she gets married. He wants her to decide who she will marry, when she will marry. And he wants her to play a meaningful part. You know, not all Afghan men are that way or this way. You know, there's complexity in every society. There's variety in every society. And to say what's wrong with Afghan men, I think is way, 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 way too simplistic a statement. That said, in some of the tribal regions in Afghanistan, and particularly in the very ultra-religious conservative tribal regions, Taliban-style oppression of women has been going on for a long time. I mean, that's the mentality in those regions. And if you want to talk about why in those regions some men or many men feel that way about women, that's a different question. But I want to dismiss the notion categorically that Afghan men, as a general, feel this way about women, because they don't.
There's a lady in the pink right in front of that gentleman in the red.
I'm a school librarian, and I like your novels because of the historical fiction and the cultural background that will then entice students to pursue the factual nonfiction end of Afghanistan, culturally, historically. You do such a good job with character description. I'd like to know where... you've only been back to Afghanistan one time? All right. So where are you getting your insight as to the feelings of Afghan women and different Afghan men? Is it from a community of Afghans and listening or researching?
Well, I mean, I've lived in the States for years, but I live in an Afghan community. I grew up around Afghans in Afghanistan. In the United States, I've lived around Afghans for the better part of 27 years. I deal with them all day. I read a lot, and I try to educate myself about what's going on. In writing these novels, I have felt very confident and very much in my element. And as I say, even from my fellow Afghans, I haven't received a whole lot in the sense of this is inaccurate or this doesn't sound ring true or this. You know, I met in 2003, I met a lot of people in Kabul. And I went there for the purpose of educating myself, of filling in the gaps for myself, of seeing for myself what had happened in Kabul. And I was astounded at the enormity of what had happened there. And then I talked to men, women, children, the elderly and the young, and they would tell me these stories, some of which I'll never repeat. And I willfully kept out of this novel, but some of which made its way into the novel. And eventually, as I spoke to people, and a lot of women wouldn't speak with me. I mean, you can't walk up in Kabul to a woman in burqa and start a conversation. But many women would, women who worked in NGOs, who were teachers, and so on and so forth, and they would relate to me things that they had seen and what had happened. So it filled in the gaps for me. And when I came away from there and I began to write this novel about a year later, I felt I had this, you know, incredible wealth of anecdotes, vivid details, stories. And this novel is based not only on my previous knowledge and understanding of Afghanistan, but also on my collective sense of the difficulties and the struggles and hardships of those people that I met, as well as their, you know, their courage and their endurance, all those people that I met in 2003.
A lot of hands, but we only have time for a few more questions. The lady right here in the orange and white.
I've often wanted to ask a person, a writer, whose work was made into a film, the question I'm finally going to have a chance to ask. How much input did you make into the film? Were you happy with the film?
Well, I willfully stayed out of the... sounds like a terrible pun. Stayed out of the picture. I made myself available to the filmmakers, who were actually very gracious. Whenever they made a decision or they asked for my opinion and we discussed things. I mean, I remember when the script was first written, and I really didn't want to write the script, but they hired David Benioff, who was a wonderful writer, and he wrote the script. And I remember us talking at length about the script, and they asked me to draft a letter about my various feelings about it, and they drafted their own letter, and we went back to David, and then he rewrote, and we talked again. And I said, you know, if you have questions about, you know, cultural matters, linguistic matters, you know, you can come to me. I'm happy to answer anything. So it was kind of a partnership. And I decided that it would not be particularly useful for me to keep butting in, that it was their film and their project, and that it would be helpful for me to just kind of let them do their job. It's not particularly easy to do, because, you know, you spend all this time creating this thing and then you hand it to somebody else and they essentially go about, you know, changing it to some extent. But, you know, there's some writers who will never be able to accept this and some writers who will. And I was able to kind of detach myself from the idea that everything I wrote on the pages of that novel has to be on the screen. And I think film is its own art form, and inevitably there's going to be a divide. My view is to judge that film as its own entity, rather than, you know, is it just like the novel? I think it's more important that it stays true to the spirit of the novel. So we'll see. I saw an early rough cut a couple of months ago. You know, there was virtually no special effects. The dialogue was really all over the place a little bit. And the music was all temporary. But it was very moving. And even as the writer of that story, I found myself completely swept away by the narrative. And my wife bawled through the whole thing. So.
Let's take a few more questions. Right here in the front row.
As a fellow Afghan, I just have one personal question to ask you. And the question is, we all reach a point in our career that we become successful and we feel obligated to give back. What advice can you offer for helping in reconstructing Afghanistan?
Oh, you know, I appreciate the question, but it is not up to me to offer advice on how to reconstruct Afghanistan. I am way out of my element in trying to answer that question. I don't know.
I'm sorry, I read it wrong. Not advice, more like we are, us were consumed by dollars that we're not going to go back to go live there to help reconstruct with whatever careers that we have. How would you motivate, or what advice would you give for giving back or helping out?
I neither have any desire to motivate people. I have no advice to give to people. I feel that has to come from within. If somebody feels the motivation to go back to Afghanistan and help, then they'll do it. I don't think anybody's going to leave their life behind and purchase a plane ticket because Khalid Husseini said so. So I don't have any advice to people. I don't overestimate my influence in the slightest bit. In the grand scheme of things, people run their own lives. I can only decide for myself. And I have been incredibly fortunate in virtually every turn of my life. And so I feel a sense of social responsibility. I feel that it has been a blessing for me to have this novel that has been read by so many people and that has afforded me a kind of a public forum, and that it would be a tragic waste of an opportunity if I use that just to trump myself up or try to, you know, I feel that's an opportunity to do something that is meaningful, important, and serious. And so when the UNHCR, which Morris spoke about earlier, when the UN Refugee Agency asked me to work with them, that was exactly what I was looking for. You know, as you know, Afghanistan has had one of the world's largest refugee populations, over 8 million at one point, still I think over 2 million Afghan refugees in the world today. And so this is an issue that was close to my heart, and I always wished I could do something about it. Suddenly, because of the success of the Chiron, I have that chance. And so I didn't let it go by. And so I've been working with the UN on the issue of the refugees. But every person has to decide for themselves, has to look inside and decide for themselves. It isn't, I am not one to give advice or try to motivate people because I don't think that works.
Ladies and gentlemen, that is where we're going to have to end it. Please join me in thanking Khaled Hosseini.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.